Welcome back to the Dreadful Dialogue, a podcast where we chat about all things horror. I'm your host, Elise. As usual, I have my phenomenal co-host, Kristen.
Hello, how are you?
And if you're actually on YouTube and watching this, you will see we have a guest with us today. We have the fantasy author, John David, known for the Morgala Chronicles. He's going to share a lot about that at the end. Probably heard him before. I think he's, besides Kristen, because Kristen started as a guest and became our co-host, I think you've been on the most. You've been on The Howling, American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, correct.
Gremlins 1 and 2.
Correct.
So we've had him on several times, and he's a huge fan of today's movie because we're staying in the summer theme, continuing our summer theme series. We've got all our Jaws gear on over here.
So 1975,
the original Jaws. That's what we're going to be covering today. So go ahead and hit us with the synopsis, Kristen.
Sure. When a series of deadly shark attacks threatens a small beach town, police chief Martin Brody teams up with marine biologist Matt Hooper and a seasoned shark hunter Quint to track down the massive great white responsible for all of this. As the hunt moves from the shoreline to the open sea, the trio faces a terrifying battle for survival against one of cinema's most iconic predators. Dun, dun, dun. So that's a synopsis.
Doing it. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Downstairs. Anyway. All right. So let's get right into this. Let's get right into our discussion. So the film opens up Amity Island. Our first death is this girl Chrissy. She's having fun. She's gone skinny dipping. And this is when we get our first victim from our unseen monster. We meet Police Chief Martin Brody, and he is played by
Roy Scheider.
It's okay. Roy Scheider. I'm thinking of Quint, apparently.
Who's a legend, by the way.
He is a legend. Yeah, he's in a lot of things. He wants to close down the beaches, but the Mayor Larry Vaughn, he is determined to keep the beaches open for the July 4th weekend. Before we even get into this, to the blood of all this, and, you know, I want you guys to think back. Tell me about the first time you guys watched the movie. If you can remember.
Yeah, I know it's one of those films that's in the zeitgeist that you really don't remember the actual first time. I mean, same with Star Wars. That's another one that you don't remember the first time. They saw it on TV at one point. But my parents had absolutely no problem with me watching a shark eat people. So
I probably watched it way too young. It's very much like what John David said. Like, I don't remember precisely when. I just remember, like, watching it multiple times when I probably shouldn't have been watching it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same for me. I don't recall. I just know I almost feel like I never properly watched the whole movie through as a kid. I think it was just a staple. It was on all the time, and you just, like, catch a couple scenes. And it wasn't until, like, I got older, I watched it more critically, and especially for this episode, that I realized, like, it's such a buddy movie. Like, I had forgotten that.
Yeah, it really is. The cast is good. As you said, Roy Scheider is Martin Brody, and Robert Shaw is Quint. And you know what's so sad? I read that he passed away, like, only 2 years after this movie came out. I'm like, man. Richard Dreyfuss is Matt Hooper. By the way, Richard Dreyfuss is not a good person. IRL, but we're going to just pretend that it doesn't exist in the movie. Lorraine Gary is Ellen Brody, and then Marie Hamilton is the mayor, Larry Vaughn.
Yeah, so good cast. A lot of people.
Good cast.
Yeah, focus is mainly on the three characters: Quint, Brody, and Hooper, of course. So back to that opening kill. It was pretty legendary. How do you guys think the film created fear right out of the gate without us actually seeing the shark?
Well, ironically, it's the primary reason why you don't see the shark. They wanted to show the shark a lot more. Spielberg wanted to, but the shark wasn't working. And it ended up being for the film's benefit. It makes you use your imagination. And that's really 10 times more terrifying. You know something is underneath the water. You know it's a shark, and then you find out that it's a shark. Okay, but then you find out, whoa, it's a really, really big shark. Only a big shark could have mauled that girl that horribly. And I know this isn't the first film, and it certainly wasn't the last film to use it, but it's such an effective tool think of like Friday the 13th or whatnot, where you hear the music playing, says, oh, you know the killer's somewhere. You don't know where he is, but he's close. Another film, you mentioned American Werewolf in London. When Jack and David are on the moors, you hear the howling in the distance, and then you hear the growling of the animal just outside, that they're just outside their view. It's somewhere, you know it's there. And it's forcing you to use your imagination. And it's such an effective tool.
Yeah. I love it. And I love that you brought up that the fact that they didn't actually use it was because it wasn't functioning. They had done the tests for the mechanical shark in water, you're in fresh water, and Bruce, and they end up using it in salt water, and it's like gave it all kinds of issues.
Yeah.
Whole shark going across the screen. Have either of you been to, because I know you both have like a history, both of you've lived in Florida at some point, if I recall correctly. Have you guys ever, do they have Jaws at the Florida Universal Studios? Because we have it in Hollywood, California.
I haven't been there since I was six.
I'm almost confident they took that away, but I hear that they want to bring something back. They at one point had a section of Universal Studios devoted to Amity Island, at least at the California location. I'm not too sure about the Florida. There used to be Jaws at the Florida location, but it's gone now, to my understanding.
Yeah, it was. Well, when I went maybe twice growing up, and I do recall being on like the tram that takes you through it. And then they're like, oh, the Jaws broke down again. Oh, it broke down again. And it's like, it's just like the movie. All right, let's keep moving along. So after we have that grand opening, we get to realize how sleepy of a town Amity Island is. Like all of the problems that are going on are kind of petty, you know, problems that you'd be lucky to have in a small town. There doesn't seem to be murders. There doesn't seem to be anything bad. Police Chief Brody is originally from New York. He's not an original Islander. And I love that Secretary Polly, she says, one of the biggest problems they're having is the karate kids keep karateing the picket fence. I'm a kid. I found that hilarious. I would go around like, I'm a karate stuff. So I had to zoom that in.
So funny.
So we don't know what we don't realize how dramatic, how bad it is. Everybody wants to keep the beach open. It's a town where they depend on tourist money. And the mayor is like, we can't shut this down. Like, and people are like, can we just say it's a bear? What do you say? Like, we could say barracuda. And it's not until we get to the beach and we get the little boy, Alex. He gets killed in broad daylight. And the mother puts a bounty on this, you know, somebody to bring the shark to get the shark, that we realize like how serious this is. That's when we get introduced to Hooper. He comes into town. So when I want to talk about Alex's death, and I want to talk about that epic scene. What did you guys first think when we see that scene where it zooms in on Brody on the beach and he sees Alex?
Yeah, that classic.
I think he called it like a dolly zoom in.
Yeah.
That scene actually was going to be a little more brutal. There is a black and white photograph of the boy in the water, and just the mechanical shark is just right up behind him. So apparently they're about to show. I had to know a lot more. And they had to tone it down to not get that R rating. But I recall seeing that part as a kid and just going,
yeah.
Wait a minute. This movie's willing to kill kids? Whoa, they're not playing around here. And just like if a kid could die, then the stakes are pretty high here for this film, and you feel terrible that somebody so innocent could get killed. And I really don't see this as a monster flick per se. I see it more as like a disaster flick, whether it be the towering inferno or earthquake or something like that. Because these townspeople are going up against a force of nature; they're not going up against a villain per se, really. So, that scene certainly hit home.
Yeah, I didn't know that they had to tone it down so much, but I guess it makes even more sense because it is a kid, and like I think there's only technically like 5 human deaths. I think that's the most minorly disturbing of all of them that we see. I mean, death is disturbing and of course, but that's kind of the one, it doesn't hit you as hard. I mean, I think even we get that little fake jump scare with the kids messing around with the shark fin.
Smack them.
Yeah.
What did they do it?
And I think Spielberg actually wanted to have more deaths in the movie, but either he was denied or would have been too tough or something like that. Or the dude, again, Bruce isn't working.
I love. Do you guys know why they named him Bruce?
Yeah, because of his lawyer. Spielberg's the lawyer.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg. Yeah, I don't think we mentioned the director, Steven Spielberg, and the music, the soundtrack. John Williams, he's no slouch. He's done Star Wars, tons of things. We could give his whole list, but we don't want to take up all that time.
Yeah, he listened to a lot of time.
Yeah. What did you guys think about the mayor, that it took this incident for him to finally shut down the town or shut down the beaches? Because, I mean, he was an infuriating guy.
I just thought it was like typical politician behavior, wanting the money.
Yeah.
To play devil's advocate. Well, remember, it wasn't until the third attack with the guy in the boat, you see his leg fall to the bottom. When the mayor finally stepped up and said, you know, he realized that my kids were on that beach too.
Yeah.
And that's when he really stepped up.
The leg, and then later we get a head. But it's still infuriating nonetheless. Brody was kind of the only one like, okay, maybe I'm just being a New York cop, but I'm being paranoid. I mean, I'm sure, granted, he didn't deal with sharks before, but it was like, I was annoyed with the mayor that it was like, I understand. I live in a town where I live close to a lake and they're doing construction to protect the people that live near a lake. They're creating a spillway and it's not shutting down businesses, but it's wrecking havoc on our traffic. And there's lots of people on like social media and stuff. But I'm also like, dude, if there's a flood, I want my home. I want to survive.
Yeah.
So I understand how frustrating it can be, but it's for the betterment of everybody. Like, we're just going to have to suck it up and we're going to have traffic for 2 years. But
there you go. Yeah. Well, again, to play devil's advocate for the mayor, I was actually kind of reminded when COVID happened. I'm standing there, all the businesses are shutting down, to which, wow, is this kind of what it was like in Jaws? People are afraid and people are concerned, and you have to balance that between fear. You want to be concerned, but you don't want to create a panic at the same time. And Quint hit the nail on the head during the meeting when he said, well, we ought to deal with this problem now, or you'd be on welfare.
Yeah.
I thought that was exactly right. Quint was like, we can mess around. The mom offered, what was it, $3,000 initially? He's like, you guys will give me $10,000 and I'll make it happen. I'm going to bring this shark in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
great scene of Quint.
Let's get it done quick. Let's not let these, because, you know, eventually we get this group of men that come in or for out of towners. Everybody's coming in, throwing dynamite in the water, overcrowding boats. And they're really trying. They think like, oh, cool, we're going to go get this shark in. And Quint just sat back like, okay, whatever. Again, it's not until that next attack that they finally took care of this. And Hooper, also going into Hooper, what did you guys think about when he first came onto the scene?
Oh, I liked him right away. I think he's obviously the professional. Well, both he and Quint are professionals, just kind of doing the same job, just doing it in a different perspective. It's like they're two cops. One plays by the rules, one doesn't, but they both believe in law and order. They both want the same thing. They want the attacks to stop. And if it takes the death of the shark, then so be it. I'm really glad that Hooper wasn't like, no, we must protect this animal, to which, oh no, sorry, the animal's got it. We have to cut off its food supply or we kill it. One or the other. He's not, I like the fact that Hooper puts human life first.
So then when we get that false victory with the tiger shark, again, that's after we get the people who've gone out, not Quint, the other guys that have gone out, different people, they bring in a shark, we get a tiger shark, we think this is it, we've got it. And Hooper has to be the one to be like, based on my autopsy I did, I'm measuring this, like, I don't, you know, the jaws of this animal do not match up the jaws of the attack that I on the attack that I saw of this body that he examines. I like that they finally decide, hey, we're going to figure this out. Despite the townspeople thinking they got a victory, he goes and convinces Brody, hey, like, we need to go do this. Let's go look for it tonight. And I love the way that, like, Hooper comes in and, like, eats his dinner, brings in the wine. He knows, like, I'm going to cater to that, to the fact that, like, this guy wants to do this. He knows it's not true.
Yeah.
It's kind of maybe the smarter way to do it, right? We're not going to create the panic. We've already got news people thinking that we've got the victory. Let's go ahead and let's just go do this tonight. And that's when we get our first jump scare on the boat with the head. You know if that jump scare got you? You guys were younger?
A little bit, yeah. Well, actually,
definitely.
Well, you asked what was the most suspenseful scene. And that was Hooper diving into the water at night and just everybody's thinking the same thing. What are you doing? You're insane.
Right.
We realize later how much he's down for the cause when him and you start comparing scars of their different encounters with animals, him and Quint. But yeah, that scene got me with that floating head. I read that wasn't originally filmed either, that Spielberg went back later and filmed that in like somebody's pool because he wanted a better jump scare. So I thought that was great when I read that.
And he spent his own money.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, he bet like a few grand of his own money. Here it is. He was only 26 at the time and still starting out. He only had one movie under his belt before that.
Yeah, and I think he was pretty worried with the budget because they ended up going super over. It took them a lot longer than they had initially planned for it to be filmed because they filmed it on Martha's Vineyard. So it was a real place. So like some of the people weren't even extras. They were just townspeople. All the problems with the mechanical shark with Bruce not working. So that's amazing to hear that he was like down to spend his own money, because I know he was even like scared, like people aren't gonna hire me after this. This is gonna be terrible. I'm gonna be the guy who went over budget, went over time, but it worked. It was almost genius that the shark didn't work, because then he made the movie work even better. So
I think
he had the upper hand in the end.
I think that really, besides the shark not working, actually helping the movie more than it hurt it, there was kind of like that fear of failure, to which he still had that possibility that you could fail at this. So you really have to work hard to make it a good film. And I do kind of feel bad for him, because apparently he was like hospitalized for exhaustion or something, or stress.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I feel something about it. Yeah, I feel bad for him. But when you take a look at the $250 million films that are being released now, we got no problems. Yeah, no problem whatsoever. This film, they had to keep it under budget. They had to work hard. And that's another reason why you really admire the film. I think that if you're going into the film industry, you not only have to watch this film and dissect it, you have to watch documentaries as to how the film was made and why it's such a cultural impact, because it is such an important film in regards to that.
Yeah, and there's so many documentaries and so many things you can find about it. I watched a couple and I read a few, and it's like it became information overload. It's almost like maybe I did too much. Sometimes you do too much research, you're like, okay, my brain is overwhelmed. But there's really good stuff out there to watch, especially since we just had, we're year 51. Last year was the 50th anniversary. They re-released a lot more things. There's still interviews coming out. So those are all definitely worth checking out, even if you're not going into the film industry just as a fan. It'll make you appreciate it even more. So eventually we finally convince, you know, the mayor, hey, we're going to go out. We got to do this. They get Quint on board. And to me, this is where, did it feel like to you guys, the movie almost feels like two different movies? Like,
it does.
Yeah. And then it just becomes like this typical, like, Goonies,
buddy bunnies. Let's do this. Rah, rah. We got this. Yeah. It's like a major shift where it goes from, oh no, what are we going to do? Plan, to, you know?
Yeah.
That's how it was back then a lot too with movies.
Yeah.
Plan, and then it seals it up in like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, no, exactly. It's almost like the entire half of the film.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting because the energy changes for the film. And we start to learn even more about them. We find out more about Hooper's past. We find out that he has money. He had this tricked out boat that he was using earlier. And I always find myself, like when I was a kid, I always wondered, like, why didn't they use Hooper's boat? But then as an adult, I'm like, oh, it makes sense. Quint is a seasoned sailor. He's going to use his boat. Even if it looks ragtag, like this is his boat. So thinking of that, who did you find yourself connecting most out of the three of them?
Oh, hands down, Brody.
Okay, Brody.
Because even though he's a cop, he's being kind of forced into situations that he's never faced. He could be a plumber for all I know, and he happens to know how to use a gun. But he's being put on a boat, and he really doesn't know anything about seamanship. And surrounded by these two guys who know a million times more things about him in regards to this. But you know what? Put the three of them in New York. And I'll tell you, Brody becomes the alpha.
Yeah.
Right.
What about you, Kristen? Which one did you...
I would love to say Quint because he's just so gung-ho and determined, because I'm kind of like that. Like when I get a thought in my head, there's no stopping me. I'm so stubborn and I need to follow through. But then the logical side, I'm also kind of like Brody, where I'm like, I need to really think about this and I care about other people too much and this is wrong and I have to make it right. So I kind of saw myself in both of them. How about you, Elise? Who did you relate to?
That's a tough one. I don't know who I related to the most. Part of me wanted to stand behind Brody because of some of the same sort of reasons that John David said. But another part of me was like, and it was funny because I'd forgotten he was a veteran. And as he's talking and he's telling his silly stories, it takes me back. And I'm starting to think, I'm like, this guy's got veteran vibes. And I know I'm a combat veteran myself. And like, I find him so endearing because that's what happens when you're like, he's off on the sea by himself all the time.
I wasn't
in the Navy, I was in the Army, but like you get kind of kooky sometimes and it's kind of living in a war zone, or for him, even if he's not in a war zone, like to me, being out on the sea, that's terrifying, period. Like,
I catch it on a boat in the ocean.
I've gone on cruises, but like I try to not think about like it.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would have put my faith in Quentin, which I would have, to me, in the moment, I probably would have been like, he's been on the water the most. Yeah, the other guy's got, Hooper's got the brains of, like, he understands the animal. He's done his research. He's a shark guy. But I probably, to my own demise, would have totally followed Quint because of just the crazy veteran vibes, which I probably shouldn't call him crazy. I'm putting down my own people, but
yeah.
That would have been my downfall.
He was funky. Not kooky.
I know Brody's like even killed this. Really did in that situation. That's something I strive at. I'm really good at like in the moment, I don't freak out if like an emergency happens. I freak out later. I go home and then I get emotional about it. And I have a drink and I calm down and the adrenaline rush goes away. That's how I always handle things in the military. If we have an emergency, I work with one of my students and like it's like you have to call 911 type of emergency. It's like later I'm like, oh my God, like, you know what could have happened? Then I freak out. So I think I would be more like Brody, but I would have stood behind Quint.
Right. I totally get what you mean.
Yeah. I would have followed Quint's lead for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he says do this, just hey, I'm not going to question it because we're here to kill the shark and survive. We want to go home.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that too.
Which takes us into a famous scene, right? And we're going to get into another famous line where nothing's happening. He's like, Brody's playing solitaire. And Paul's cousin quit playing. Quint's like, quit playing with yourself. And he makes him start chumming. And he's kind of annoyed. And he's got a cigarette in his mouth and his glasses. And that's when we finally get to see. This is the first time. This is the second time. This is the second time we get to see him out of the water, right? We saw him in the boat a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. We saw when he killed the one guy. Yeah. We just saw briefly how big it is.
Yeah. And but we got a good view of Bruce Jaws this time, and that's when you're like, oh, snaps. And he's like, we're going to need a bigger boat. I love that line.
One of the best ad-lib lines ever.
Yes, ad-lib.
Yeah.
It's used all the time, and people probably don't know where it came from.
Apparently, yeah. I think everybody knows where that line comes from. We're going to need a bigger boat. But apparently a lot of the dialogue is ad-libbed. And this is where you trust your actors to really sink into the role, to really suck themselves up along with the character that they're playing and just let them do their thing. That's what, if you don't like it, that's what editing is for. But yeah, that's just where, well, Brody, you're going to see this shark for the first time. And it's huge.
Yeah.
What do you say?
I would feel the same way. I was like, why are we on this again? That's when I would be wondering, like, can we be on the tricked out boat with the cameras or whatever? I mean, which I thought was pretty cool for being in the 70s. I'm like, man, it sounded more like a boat from the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
So they finally see him. They're attaching yellow barrels to him. That night they kind of bond over each other. They bond. They start drinking. They start sharing war stories. I call them war stories. They start sharing war stories, essentially, with their different scars. And we get Quint's speech about the Indianapolis. Arguably one of the best monologues in cinema. What do you guys think about that?
Again, this is where you trust your actors. And one of the reasons, Robert Shaw just nails this role so completely. And he can't imagine anyone else playing the role. and where you really trust the actor to just take it and go with it. And that is the sign of a really great actor taking the dialogue. You can take whatever dialogue they have written down, or you just take, okay, this is the story. You're a survivor of the Indianapolis. You saw this happen, this happened, this happened. Now tell the story. And I'm reminded of Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing from Star Wars. These actors, they were so lucky to get these actors too for that film. And it just shows how great they are, because they just took what a great actor makes, a great performance. And Robert Shaw just nails it. Yeah. And he also scares you, really. He scares you back into reality.
Yeah.
You forget for a moment what they're going through. Again, it's almost like they're in a war zone. You forget what what their mission is and what they're actually trying to accomplish. And then, it makes you appreciate understanding where Quint is coming from. And it makes you understand some of the decisions he makes later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love that. And there is some sort of truth to that story. There was a boat that went in, did drop off the bombs that were going to go to do for Hiroshima. But from everything that we gathered, not all of the people actually got killed from sharks. They kind of took a real story and tweaked it a little.
Well, the survivors are thinking a lot. There were quite a few deaths because of the sharks.
Yeah, but not all of them because of the sharks.
Of course, yeah.
Right.
The detail that he got in this. But he nailed it, man. That's that monologue.
It was so good.
Yeah, I'd like to point out also that it shows why Quint even went into sharking in the first place. He's Ahab. A lot of people compare him to Ahab, and I certainly see that analogy. But instead of chasing just one white whale, he's chasing an entire species of animal. And he suffers from survivor's guilt and him dealing with, I guarantee you, he suffers from nightmares. And how he deals with this is by killing the sharks, and that's the only way that he could. A lot of people would never have set foot on a boat again, but not him. The way that he does it is to attack it, is to attack the problem, is to attack his pain, and kill sharks, especially kill this one.
Yeah. So you would consider him a hero then?
Tortured hero. Let's just say that.
Yeah,
tortured hero.
Yeah. I think we find out later. I don't completely agree with some of his decisions that he starts making. Like when we get a phone call from the wife and he's like, he's fine. Again, during my rewatch, because I hadn't done a proper good rewatch in so long, I was like, oh my God. Like, even though I knew the ending of the movie, I'm like, that's terrible. Like, now everybody thinks everything's happy go lucky. Like, that's your version of a distress signal. I mean, the way he pounds the radio in, he's just
that's the worst decision.
Yeah, like those are the times where you're like, oh, maybe I should have put my faith in this guy. But then you think back to his story and how determined he is. He's like, I'm going to be on my own. We're taking out the shark. We don't need a bigger boat. We don't need help. Like, he's really determined. We're doing this. The story, I think, really helps make sense of those decisions that he makes, even though I don't agree with him.
I'm with you. He definitely leans into that stubborn, I know what's best kind of mindset just because of the experience he has. And that really drives his decision-making, which doesn't really go that well in his favor, unfortunately.
No. First, we put Hooper down in the cage. They decided to put Hooper in a cage.
In the cage, yeah. Which that would have been a hell to the gnaw for me, by the way.
Which I was decision granted. But the next
thing. I'd also like to point out that it was Quint who brought up the subject of the shark cage, to which they sit there for a minute, and I think they're all wondering, what are we going to do now? We're running out of options, or we have run out of options. And Quint said, okay, Hooper, what do you got? What can you do? To which, well, I'm going to hit him with this needle. Says, you can't do this. Well, I can if I hit him in the mouth. He's probably thinking, not even I would do that. Did you ever hear the story about how Hooper got his reprieve? He was originally supposed to die.
That's what I heard, that he was, because it's something like disease.
There's a boatload of changes with the book. A million to one changes. And one of the biggest changes is that Hooper was supposed to die, and he was supposed to die in the script. But they had gotten this great Australian filmmaker who made a documentary about great whites, like the greatest documentary about great whites ever. and we need some footage of some real footage of great white sharks. Can you do anything? And they filmed a real shark attacking a real cage, a miniaturized cage, to make it look like the cage was actually was movie trickery to make it look like that. But the cage was empty.
They didn't have the dummy, right?
They had a dummy. They at one point had a real diver, but he was really small. So in relation to Richard Dreyfuss, he looked like you couldn't tell who it was. But so the shark was tearing apart the cage, and the footage was just so great that, okay, well, we would need it, but the diver isn't in there. Well, I guess Hooper survives it, huh? So they have Hooper survive.
Yeah, I do remember being as a kid thinking, there's no way. Like, and then you're like, nah.
That's
you. Yeah, there were
like, he's like hiding behind, what was he hiding behind? Like a boulder, not a boulder, but like he's hiding behind it. Yeah, and I'm just like, even as a kid, I'm like, how is the shark not finding him? You know?
Because it's a dumb animal, that's why. The shark feeds the boat and it's going for the boat. Yeah, they're turning across their cage. Okay, I'm going for this boat now. There are a boatload of change. No offense, no pun intended. A boatload of changes from the book, being an author myself. I've read quite a few books that were based off of films or films were based off of. And I've seen the films first and then I read the books. And I never read Jaws, but I know what goes on in it. There's like a mob subplot. There's a subplot with Hooper and a brooding wife and all this stuff. And when they were first making the film, coming out with the screenplay, it says, okay, number one, those two things go away. We're streamlining this plot. Okay, we're making this just a straight up man versus nature film. And we're not forgetting all this other stuff. And it's one of those situations where I think, there are quite a few movies that are better than the books, and this is one of them.
Yeah. I don't think it would have made the relationship between the three guys not as entertaining. And that's like part of the film that makes
it is.
That it's this trio buddy film, even though they're butting heads at times, like sorry to bring in like another military example, but like that's how it is in the military. Like there can be times where like you can't stand it. Like I had people, we did not like each other. We did not get along. We did not have the same personal beliefs. We didn't, for whatever reason, whether it was petty or real genuine reasons to not like each other. It was like, no, when we're in the shit, like we have each other's back. I don't care, because like we're all in this together. Like we gotta be a team. We're not gonna make it if we don't function as a team, if we don't put our petty problems to the side and deal with what's in front of us. It wouldn't have worked. There's no way you would buy into these guys looking out for each other and even being down to go on this boat together if one of them had slept with the other guy's wife. So I thought that was totally made sense. It wasn't needed in the movie. It would have distracted from the storyline.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
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 So I want to go back into Quint and his poor decision. So we talked about suspenseful scenes. For me, that was the most suspenseful scene. First, when the boat's starting to go down, the first time it does it, you know, get a pump and the boat's okay. And then later it starts to actually sink. And when we get Quint's death, like that part as a kid, I do remember that one scaring me. I was more scared of the fact the boat was sinking because I was like, oh my God, they're all gonna die. Like,
I know.
The boat going down. Like, what is going on here? That part got me the most.
And when I was rewatching it last night, even though I already knew what was happening, like I did feel panic, like inside, like growing up on the Jersey Shore and like my parents going through like Hurricane Sandy and stuff and like all the flooding. Like, I don't know. It just brought that anxiety back to me, even though I already knew what was happening. But no, I know. I was like, oh my God, no.
Yeah. It didn't sit well.
No, not at all.
Yeah, just the dragging Quint into the water. That might be the most disturbing image, really.
I think it is, personally.
That got me more. Yeah.
That's the part that got me the most. I still remembered watching it as a kid, and that part scared me. So what about you, Kristen? You never told us what you thought was the most essential part.
Oh, that one for sure. Yeah, that whole thing with the boat starting to sink and flood, Quint like fighting for his life. He's trying to get lifted, like pull himself up, and Brody's trying to help him, but he really can't because like they're all wet. It's slippery. They're going down. Yeah, that one was the most suspenseful for me. I don't want to see like a little kid die, of course. Like that was awful. But this, I feel like this was like definitely the most thrilling part of the movie.
It's more graphic, you know?
Yeah, it was very graphic. Like, yeah.
You actually see it.
Yeah, exactly. And like, there's that one point, and I remember it scaring me when I was a kid too, when I was watching it, when Quint is like basically being eaten, and like, you see all the blood come out of his mouth too. Like, even though I already knew what was happening, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's so disturbing. Like, I couldn't imagine being in that situation. Like, how freaking terrifying to be attacked like that and you have no control whatsoever. Like, you know, the anxiety overload, dude. Like,
and then the boat is sinking.
Right on top of that, it's like,
oh, the white flood. And nobody's going like, to find us because you messed up the radio and
exactly,
everything.
Exactly. Like, totally fucked. Right, exactly. Like, there's no saving him. And then Brody, like, he's just watching his, like, weirdo friend get eaten. And he's, like, totally helpless. And then he's like, where's Hooper? Where did he go? What is happening?
He thought Hooper was dead.
Yeah, exactly. He thought he was dead, too. So I really felt for him. Like, he probably felt like his hands were tied. You know, there's nothing he can do to make the situation better. And he has no other choice but to try to save himself.
Yeah. So what did you guys think about the kill?
Yeah.
Of
Bruce?
Did you guys think that was legit? When I rewatch it, I'm like, it seems kind of far off, but I guess they had to get him.
Completely 100% unrealistic and total Hollywood. And yet, it totally works.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Right, it was like the ending you needed. You're like, okay, they got him. I'm like, I don't think.
A satisfying ending. Yeah, you want to see this guy get his head blown off. But apparently in the book, again, another positive change from the book, apparently the shark just dies from that exhaustion. They fight to the point to where, okay, the shark has finally died. One of them is going to give up, the humans or the shark. And finally, the shark just dies. And Quint's death was far different in the book as well. He gets caught up in a line, in a harpoon line, and the shark pulls him into the water and he drowns. This is far more impactful, and it really sticks with you completely. So yeah, again, the movie did it better. Sorry.
Yeah. No, and it's pretty rare. You're right. I've watched quite a few movies and read the movie adaptations, and I haven't read Jaws' book, but from all the changes that I'm hearing, it sounds like the movie did a better job with the material. And it's not even so much that it doesn't mean it's not a good book. It's just some things don't translate to film from words. So
Right.
Yeah. But right. that ending of the killing of the shark. I had forgotten how dramatic how funny it was. And I love that you nailed. You're like, that's Hollywood, baby.
Benchley, and I think Peter Benchley had absolutely zero problem with the changes that they made. I think he is a lot like Stephen King in the sense to which I write books, I don't make films. And I realize that films are different than books.
Yeah.
And there you go. And you can't complain with the end, with the ending scenes of his house, how successful it was. No, it would have been better if you had gone my way. No. It's fine. As soon as he gets his royalty check, well, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and he wrote some of the screenplay, but from what I hear, he wasn't a diva on the set or anything.
Right.
You know, he wasn't upset trying to get things constantly. Like, no, I wanted it this way. So finally at the end, they put the barrel in Jaws' mouth. It gets shot. We get our Hollywood ending. Somehow, which I also found unbelievable, you get Hooper and you get Brody. They paddled ashore on the barrels. I didn't find that very believable, but again,
how are we gonna get there? The only other option is maybe like the Coast Guard finds them. I suppose I thought that's more realistic ending.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I will note also, and I've told this to other people and they don't believe me, or they didn't notice, is that if you've ever seen, have either of you seen Jaws 2?
If I have, I don't remember. I read the
synopsis. I don't remember.
And it sounded super familiar, so I think I've only seen it once. I have not seen anything beyond that one for sure.
I like calling it what I like to call the worthy sequel, to which it's a good film in and of itself. It does not surpass the original, but it is enjoyable. But the barrels that they're paddling back to shore on, the barrel, one of the barrels makes a cameo in Jaws 2.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yes. Turns out Brody turned it into a planter, and it's in front of the Brody house. It's a blank, and you'll miss that moment.
I love that for him.
And you just see it twice, to which, wait a minute, you rewind. That's one of the barrels. To which, that's what he did. And I told a friend of mine this. And at first she didn't believe me, but no, she didn't call me a liar. But she's like, man, I would throw that thing away. It would have been a reminder of what I went through. To which, trust me, he remembers what he went through regardless. Something like that is more like a trophy. Yeah, yes. It's a trophy. Seeing as that the rest of the shark is gone. I got nothing else with the shark. So I don't have the jaws to show off. Well, maybe there's a funny story with that planter.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know that. I'll have to actually watch part two.
Yeah.
Well, getting closer to the end here. So Jaws, basically, it invented the concept of a summer blockbuster, and we're at over 50 years later. Why do you guys think it still scares audiences to this day?
The reality of it.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a semi-realistic story. A shark can kill a person. Sharks are absolutely real. Again, the movie makes you use your imagination. It doesn't rely on special effects to tell not only a good story, but a scary story as well. And it's amazing that it has a PG rating. You know why it has a PG? How it got
no PG-13 yet.
Well, there's that. It would have gotten PG-13 for sure. But Spielberg, it was going to get an R rating, but Spielberg made the argument to the board, to the people making the decision, to which, why do you have R ratings for violent movies? Well, we don't want children to emulate what they see on screen. Okay? You're talking about a shark eating people. You don't see humans on human violence.
Yeah, they can't.
Earn human violence.
Yeah, you can't actually do that.
Now, wait a minute. He's right. And there you go. And they were so fortunate because having it be PG may really help to its success.
Yeah. Final question. So be honest, does this movie make you, did it ever make you scared of going into the water? And are you still scared of going into the water?
Moderately.
What about you, Kristen?
I was scared because I heard stories of people getting bitten and attacked by sharks growing up on the Jersey Shore. It was a very real thing. So I wasn't afraid to go in the beach, but it was go to the beach and like go in the water. But like I had my limits. I didn't go far out and things like that. And I still kind of do that.
I do that more now as an adult just because I'm more I'm more aware. As a kid, it didn't scare me. I think I was more scared because I grew up camping, going to the lakes, going to the beach, camping in Mexico and in Tanava. I was more scared of stingrays and jellyfish because we always had tons of jellyfish here in the Pacific.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Jellyfish, but the movie didn't scare me enough. Like I would, if I went out far and go out with my uncle, shout out to my uncle Richard. He's like, he looks like the Mexican Hulk Hogan. He's like this big guy. So I'm like, uncle's got us. Like we're fine. I don't think
it's
me. I mean, now as an adult, I'm more scared, not even of sharks. I think I'm more scared of stingrays and jellyfish. So.
Valid.
Valid. Now, I'm from Michigan and we got the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Which my dad was, we went to Fort Detroit and we went on ferries. He was one of the chaperones for our class. So here it is. My dad was with 30 kids, him and a couple other parents with 30 kids. He's looking around all these kids. And one kid's like really scared to which, hey man, I saw Jaws. There might be a shark in there. To which my dad, an old Navy guy, he looks at the kid and he goes, that's freshwater, son. No lakes, freshwater. Sharks are in saltwater, so you're good.
Yeah. I think I get scared when I go to Clearwater because our water, unfortunately, where I live is not very clean. And then when I go to areas like I've been to Spain, I've been to Hawaii, and you get in and you're like, I didn't realize how many critters are in. I'm like, give me back to my water. Know. I don't know, be different. Now I hardly get in. Now I only get in because my little one wants to get in. But it's amazing how age will change your thoughts on things.
That's for sure. But I still have the same anxiety.
Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, John David, tell us all about your books.
Well, I had to redo all four of my covers. So if you haven't seen my covers before, I had to have them redone, to which because the publisher did go out of business and they weren't letting me use the old covers. But it all turned out great. I got a lady from Gabriela. She's from Brazil. Did all these. I got my prequel here. I call my Morgellic Chronicles prequel, The Savage Peak. I like to call this My Hobbit because it's a standalone story, but introducing you to this world of Morgana and how she's forced to fight. And I got my trilogy, Diary of a Lonely Demon, The Shadow of Hell, and just this year came out War of the Dark One, the final part of my series. You can check them out at Morgana.net.
So that's where listeners can find all your books, and if they want to follow you on social media, you're also on Instagram. Okay, so you're all over all the social medias, and we'll make sure we put that in the show notes. Well, listeners, we're going to go ahead and close out at this time. But thank you so much, John David. We appreciate having
you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Fun. Great to meet you again.
Read those books because I've read Savage Peak. It is great.
If you enjoyed listening, the best way to support the show is by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more people discover the show. You can also follow us on Instagram, Dreadful Dialogue Podcast, and visit our website, dreadfuldialogue.com. If you'd like to support the podcast even further, you can donate to our Buy Me a Coffee Fund. Your support helps keep our show going and means so much to us. And thank you so much for listening today.
Yes, we hope our dialogue wasn't too dreadful for you guys. And have a good one. Be safe in the water.
Bye. See ya.